You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
A few years ago, after a Bible study comparing the Gospels' Easter narratives, someone said to me, "I am so relieved to know that I'm not crazy. Every Easter, when the story is totally different, I thought it was me. I thought I just had a really bad memory." Nope. Year to year, depending on which gospel is read, you get a whole different order of events and a whole different cast of characters. Two angels. No, wait, one. Three women. No, wait, just Mary Magdalene. Jesus putzing around in the garden. No, no, he's not here. He's already back in Galilee fixing breakfast. That's why our sunrise service is celebrated around a fire pit grilling fish. In Mark, Matthew, and John, Jesus tells the disciples to head back to Galilee or meets them there. But oh no, not Luke. That doesn't work for Luke's big dramatic opening in Acts. So he changes the story completely and has Jesus say, "Y'all just stay here in Jerusalem and wait for Pentecost." So, not only are the storylines completely different, you get a whole different theological point from each gospel. Mark's resurrection story is a call to courage in the face of fear. Matthew's gospel says, "Go, make peace and teach justice." Luke's resurrection forms a community rooted in shared meals, forgiveness, and joy. And John's resurrection is love calling your name. It's personal, relational, transformative. The bottom line, you all know some version of the story. Jesus dead, Jesus alive. The question is, what do you do now? So, instead of your typical Easter reading full of empty tombs and panicked disciples, today's passage is answering the question, what next? It's a glimpse at Jesus' very last teaching in Matthew before everything comes to an end. In fact, right after this teaching in Matthew, Jesus basically says, that's it. The jig is up. The next thing is, I'm going to be arrested and killed. So what you're about to hear is the last thing Jesus wants his disciples to remember and to hold on to after it's all over. It's a judgment scene. And again, let me remind you, it's not a prediction of a literal future. It's a parable. And just like Aesop's fables and the like, there's a moral to the story. Don't go all literal on me.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46.
When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. And then the king will say to those on his right,
"Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me."
Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?"
The king will reply, "Truly I tell you, Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me.
Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me.
They also will answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you? He will reply, truly, I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me.
Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
At the beginning of the First World War, the daughter of a Swedish diplomat looked out of the embassy window onto the street in St. Petersburg, Russia, to see German prisoners of war being transported to labor camps in Siberia. In a decision many thought was rash, she left the comforts of the diplomatic life and began visiting the prison camps. There she saw unspeakable horrors, and she, a young woman of only 24, began, almost alone, a struggle to prevail against cruelty with compassion. Serving as a volunteer nurse, she had to fight against the resistance and suspicion of the authorities. She fought against the brutality and lawlessness of the prison guards and struggled against cold, hunger, dirt, and the conditions of an undeveloped country and a destructive war. She visited the hungry, gave them food. She gave water to the thirsty and clothed the naked and strengthened the sick. Even though she was put in prison and fell ill herself, she kept working for the comfort of others. After World War I, she organized homes for the orphans of both German and Russian prisoners of war, until the coming of the Nazis forced her to leave Germany and come to the U.S. Here, she became a helper of European refugees and worked for the well-being of those suffering from the carnage of World War II. Theologian Paul Tillich wrote, "It is a rare gift to meet a human being in whom love is so overwhelmingly manifest. It undercuts theological arrogance as well as pious isolation. It is more than justice, and it is greater than faith and hope. It is the presence of God, for God is love." Tillich, who knew her for over 10 years, said they never had a theological discussion. They didn't need to. As she spent her life pouring out compassion, she rarely, if ever, even used the name of God. Doing what she did was just who she was. And who was this woman, this angel of Siberia, who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 5 times? Her name was Elsa Brandstrom. And though you've probably never heard of her, you've probably heard of a care package, right? Well, that's the organization Elsa was part of starting, the Cooperative for American Relief in Europe, otherwise known as CARE. In 2019, CARE reported 1,300 poverty-fighting and humanitarian aid projects, reaching over 92 million people directly and 433 million people indirectly. a hopelessly woke organization, CARE focuses especially on poor women. Why? Because experience has shown that, given the proper resources, women are much more inclined than men and are much more likely to help whole communities escape poverty. Flannery O'Connor is one of those writers who portrays the darker side of human nature, often in not so subtle ways. And in defense of being a little bombastic sometimes, she wrote, "For those who are hard of hearing, you have to shout." So Matthew takes her advice. In an attempt to penetrate dulled minds and insensitive souls, Matthew portrays a last judgment scene that is basically shouting to get our attention. "Goats to the left, sheep to the right. Got it?" After hearing it, the question on anyone's mind is understandably, who exactly then are the sheep? And will I be in that number? Just as a reminder, Jesus says the sheep look like this. They give the hungry food. They give the thirsty something to drink. They welcome the stranger. They clothe the naked, visit the sick, and free the prisoner. What? Hang on a second. That can't be right. I grew up being told I was in because I believed the right stuff. And let's be clear. On the Mount Rushmore of theological non-negotiables, other than the literal virgin birth, there's no other aspect of Jesus' life that evangelicals and fundamentalists hold in higher regard than the physical, bodily resurrection of Jesus. It absolutely must be a literal, historical event, or the whole Bible is flawless history book, and Jesus is who he said he is, house of cards, crumbles. And you absolutely must believe without a shadow of a doubt, or God won't love you. And God can read your mind, so be even more afraid. And while you'd think that there couldn't possibly really be people in this day and age who genuinely live in such fear, I'll remind you that 10 years ago, 8 pious pastors in Fountain Hills doubled down on belief in a physical bodily resurrection, or you get your secret Christian decoder badge revoked, which makes sense when you realize that, as a whole, their faith is equivalent to the priorities of your average toddler. Black and white thinking, fear of punishment, a belief in magic, and a transactional promise of reward for good behavior. So, here's the problem. They think that human beings will be accepted or rejected by a theistic God above the clouds on the basis of whether or not they believe the right stuff. Jesus, on the other hand, only says anything about believing in him 3 or 4 times in, you guessed it, the Gospel of John, who portrays Jesus in a way that would lead any modern shrink to declare him a hopeless narcissist. But in all the rest of the Gospels, Jesus doesn't say a thing about belief. He says it's all about a relationship to other people. And even if you can't believe what's right, they think that at the very least, being religious is all about being pure or righteous. On the other hand, Jesus hung out with all the people that the holier-than-thou religious folks reject. And he doesn't expect them to be pure. He just wants to know, are you compassionate, especially to the least of these? Friends, it's still revolutionary. Religious people just can't bring themselves to see it. But from the beginning, Jesus shocked the conventionally religious by treating those labeled unrighteous as if they were human beings. The righteous said, "Those people are sinners and deserve what fate they get." To which Jesus replied, "God help any of us if we get what we deserve. God is about grace, baby." That's in the original Greek. The righteous whined to Jesus, "But those immigrants, they're dangerous. They're all rapists and murderers. Not to mention they're eating the cats. They're eating the dogs. And if you love your enemies, they won't return the favor. We can guarantee you that." But Jesus says, "You haven't really loved anybody if the only reason you love them is for what you get out of it. That's not love, that's bartering. Love gives without any expectation of return." The religious say, "Well, if someone is in prison, especially some Central American gulag, I'm sure they deserve it. And by golly, the rules are the rules. They must have broken rules. And the rules are what's most important." And Jesus said, "Don't let the rules get in the way of doing what's right. You will be judged not by your righteousness, but by your compassion." And just in case it's not crystal clear that the sheep are not motivated by a reward, remember that they are absolutely dumbfounded by this whole scene. They ask, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink, or a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you, or sick, or in prison and visit you?" And what's the answer? You all know it. "Truly I say to you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who are members of my family, you did it to me." They can't believe it. They are totally gobsmacked. They don't even remember doing those things. They can't recall any of those deeds. When did we do them? They couldn't remember doing them because they didn't do it for some reward for themselves. They didn't do it for recognition or to earn heavenly brownie points. They did them out of compassion for a stranger and are surprised to learn they were serving Jesus. My friend Joe Bessler Northcutt teaches at Phillips Seminary in Tulsa, and he says, "This story doesn't predict a literal final judgment. It's a wisdom story about what in the final analysis matters most." So, on Easter Sunday, I ask you, what matters most? Is Christ risen? Well, I don't know. The answer really kind of depends on you. According to today's passage, you and I, are called to manifest the risen Christ. We witness to the reality of resurrection when we clothe the naked and visit the sick and imprisoned, when we protest, resist, and march, when we speak out against the cruel policies of our government, when we resist the injustices being done to the vulnerable and excluded, and when we offer the simplest of human compassion to the least of these. And granted, not all of us are wired to strive for grand works that solve the world's problems or march in the streets for justice. Maybe you're more of a one-on-one, treating a stranger or a foreigner hospitably, or an enemy decently, visiting somebody who is sick or lonely and holding their hand, a smile of recognition, a shared meal, an interest in someone's well-being or life, the kind of things that, after you do them, they're lost to your memory. But the person you did them for will never forget them. And what Jesus is saying is that those simple deeds have profound impact on the world. Episcopal priest Fleming Rutledge says, "The universe turns upon a cup of water given to the littlest ones in Jesus' name." Friends, if your only definition of resurrection is a literal anatomical one-off 2,000 years ago, then I say your God is surprisingly puny and certainly isn't paying attention to what's going on in the world. Seriously, I mean, this God can raise a body from the dead, but today can't manage to end the carnage in Israel and Gaza and Ukraine, or lift a broken spirit, heal a shattered community, comfort the ache of a crushed dream, and stands idly by while countless children starve? Oh yeah, that those are things we're supposed to tackle. As long as Easter is about what Jesus did 2,000 years ago, we can insulate ourselves from the possibility that we might have to get out of our comfort zones to change the world. Here, now, today. And that's what resurrection is all about. Not about getting some guarantee that our bodies will be reconstituted off in some vague, unknowable, distant future, but a challenge to make a decision. Will the followers of Jesus welcome the stranger, clothe the naked, visit the sick and in prison? Can we offer a cup of cold water to the least of these? Can we make the resurrected Christ real in the world? Well, don't tell me, show me. The ideas of resurrection and of Easter are finally not about the way back then or the way off in the future, but today. It's the kind of resurrection that actually means something, that breathes hope into the lives of the oppressed and the exiled, that stitches together reconciliation between enemies, that surprises those who were told that they were unworthy with acceptance and unconditional love. Bottom line, I'll take a metaphorical resurrection, alive, kicking, and feeding the hungry over your theological autopsy any day. Carol Simcox was an Episcopal priest who, many years ago, was traveling in Syria. He was alone in a hotel room in Damascus when, in the middle of the night, he was incapacitated by a sudden and painful attack of kidney stones. He called down to reception and asked for a doctor. The desk called back and said the doctor couldn't be there until the morning. He spent the night writhing in pain when, early in the morning, the maid let herself in to clean the room. She saw him there on the bed and started to leave, but couldn't help but see that he was obviously in a lot of pain. As she came closer, her demeanor changed from fear to compassion. She stretched up her hands upward and said, "Allah," as a kind of prayer, then said to Simcox, "Good soon," and left the room. Moments later, she returned with a cup of hot tea. No words were spoken as she lifted his head, put the cup on his lips, and smiled as he drank. Simcox wrote, "Through a stranger of another faith, the Lord stretched out a hand to me. It was like communion. I recalled what Christ said, 'If you have done it unto the least of these, you have done it to me.'" Vulnerable, in a foreign country, 5,000 miles from home, all alone, Simcox said, "I was the least of these. So let me get this straight. According to this parable, the Son of Man returns. Before him will be gathered all of the nations, everyone, Jew, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, believer, non-believer. And the question will not be, did you believe all the right stuff? The question will be, did you help the least of these? Yeah, that's the question. So, is Christ really risen? Well, don't tell me. Show me. Be well. Hey, and if you like what you heard today, buy me a coffee. Shukran.
Shukran. Thank you. Do it.